This podcast was recorded at the 2016 Judd Pro Live at App Show Conference in Washington, D.C. The title of this session is New Drugs and Novel Mechanisms of Action in Treating Patients with Multiple Myeloma, and it is presented by Jonathan Kaufman and Charisse Gleason, the Winship Cancer Institute of Emory University. To view the presentation material or see other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2016. To claim continuing educational credit for these activities, visit education.annenberg.net/JPL16-sessions. And now, we're delighted to bring you this podcast from Judd Pro Live.
Our next session is on new drugs and novel mechanisms of action in treating patients with multiple myeloma. Pleased to have here with us today Ms. Charisse Gleason and Dr. Jonathan Kaufman, both of the Emory University School of Medicine and Winship Cancer Institute.
All right, so Jonathan and I work together in our myeloma program at Emory, and we're going to do this talk kind of like how we work, back and forth. You know, it's very much a collaborative relationship. The advanced practice providers in the myeloma program are very involved in the clinical trials and pretty much every part of what we do, I would say. So we're going to talk to you about new drugs. These are the learning objectives. Talking about different mechanisms of action. We're going to talk a little bit about some old drugs, too. Toxicities, how we monitor, early signs of toxicities that providers need to be aware of, especially with these newer agents, and some of the newer optimal regimens, how we make our decisions about how we treat these patients, our financial disclosures.
When we think about plasma cell disorders, the first time when we see a plasma cell disorder, we make the decision about how to classify it, how to divide it. And the first thing that we do is we look at the percentage of plasma cells. And what the percentage of plasma cells does is it allows us to distinguish between MGUS, where there's less than 10% plasma cells, and the M spike is less than 3 grams per deciliter, and myeloma, when you have more than 10% plasma cells or more than 3 grams of a paraprotein. And then once we've made the diagnosis of myeloma, we then further subdivide into whether that's symptomatic or asymptomatic. And symptomatic myeloma is defined as broadly one of two things. You either have to have symptoms, and we use the acronym CRAB for the CRAB criteria, hypercalcemia, renal dysfunction, anemia, or lytic bone disease, or you have to what we have now described as myeloma-defining events. And the myeloma-defining events are those bottom three on the symptomatic myeloma chart. That is, if the bone marrow biopsy shows greater than 60% plasma cells, or the serum free light chain involved over uninvolved is greater, the ratio is greater than 100, or there's greater than one focal lesion on the MRI. Those three are new to the diagnostic criteria for symptomatic myeloma or myeloma that requires treatment. And we used to treat these patients as smoldering myeloma, but we found if a smoldering myeloma had one of those three, then 90% of those patients had symptoms in the next 6 months to 1 year. And hence we said we should just initiate therapy early. It looks like about there will be 30,000 new cases of myeloma, still with 12,000, 13,000 deaths. I think that despite the fact that we consider myeloma a very treatable disease, and every once in a while we have a patient who will get treatment and never relapse, in a large part we don't consider this a curable disease. It is a disease that typically patients present in their late 60s, early 70s. You can see myeloma in younger patients. We don't know why patients get myeloma. And then in survival, going back 20 or 30 years, was median survival was on the order of 2 to 2.5 years. If you look at probably 10-year-old data at this time, median survival was probably around 5 years. If you look at the trends in data, my presumption is when we look back at patients diagnosed in 2016, median survival will likely be on the order of at least 6 to 8 years. And from a historical perspective, the first documented cases were over 150 years ago. And then the real beginning of improvement in outcomes of myeloma came with the development of high-dose therapy and autologous transplant in the mid-90s. And then, as with the rest of oncology, in the late 90s, early 2000s, we started to see new drugs. And we saw drugs like thalidomide, lenalidomide, and bortezomib really change outcomes. And we've had improvement of those drugs with drugs like pomalidomide and carfilzomib. And then just in the past year alone, we've had 4 new drugs approved, panobinostat, elotuzumab, daratumumab, and exasumib, and we'll spend a fair amount of time today talking about those new drugs. From a smoldering myeloma standpoint, again, in smoldering myeloma, the risk of progression to myeloma is about 10% per year. And the reason we don't treat all of these patients is that even though it's about 10% per year, after the first 5 years, that percentage, that risk decreases significantly. And so there are still some patients who, if you look pathologically, for all the world, look like they have myeloma, but they don't have any symptoms, and people can go without symptoms for a very long time. No prior therapy has shown to be beneficial. There was a single study done in Spain, which looked at lenalidomide plus dexamethasone versus observation. And in that relatively small study, there was suggestion of a benefit. I think the study had such problems with design and execution that we in the United States have not incorporated that into our practice. In a large part, we're waiting on an almost completely accrued ECOG study that looks at lenalidomide versus observation in smoldering myeloma patients. And preliminary data shows that that's a safe approach, and we're just waiting on the final data to show that's effective. But with just not to look at any of these individually, but this shows you that there are many studies here in the United States asking the question, can we treat patients earlier and impact long-term outcomes? And here's a list of studies that are currently open asking that question. And again, I talked to you about the indications for treatment, the CRAB criteria, and the myeloma defining events. And then I think I'm going to turn it over to Charisse. Oh, and then one final comment, and that we have a new staging system that not only includes the old ISS staging system using beta-2 microglobulin as well as albumin, but now we're looking at underlying biology, that is the underlying high-risk fish features like 17B, 17P, 414, or 1416, as well as markers of the proliferative index like an LDH. And then we can risk stratify using all these things together into what we call a standard risk and a high risk. And those help us make decisions in a large part the way we practice. It doesn't help us make our induction decision. What it helps us make decisions is how to manage the patient after they've achieved remission. And now I will hand it over to Charisse.
So you think when a patient comes to us, the first thing that we want to think about is when for induction therapy, are they a transplant candidate or not? And it's really going to drive our decision in how we treat them, because a non-transplant candidate, you do not want to have an alkylating agent. So right now, these are the FDA-approved drugs. You've seen that. There's a long list for a somewhat rare disease. This is the NCCN guidelines. And it's interesting, I had a student with me 2 weeks ago who didn't know anything about myeloma, but she's used to looking at those NCCN guidelines, and said, how do you know how to treat? And that's a good question, and that's what we do, and that's what the data tells us. And so that's what we're gonna walk through, and to put it in perspective, we're gonna present a case throughout the rest of the talk. So we had a 65-year-old gentleman who presented with anemia, bone pain, and you can see on his initial workup, he is a bit anemic. His white count and platelets are fine. His protein is 9.9. Skeletal survey showed extensive lytic disease. his SPEP and UPEP. He's got a IgG paraprotein and a urine paraprotein. His bone marrow was about 50% and no high-risk features. So how do we decide how we're going to treat this patient? And we always want to think about a clinical trial. Not everybody wants to do that. But for our patient, we want to go back and look, what are the backbone of our treatment for induction therapy? Because like Jonathan said, we're going to look at those risk factors, but really what drives that upfront treatment is pretty standard unless your patient presents with plasma cell leukemia. So the backbone of an induction therapy has been lenalidomide and bortezomib with dexamethasone. And there's been a discussion for some time in the myeloma world, do we give two drugs or do we give three drugs? And I can tell you at our center, we've been giving three drugs for some time. And at ASH last year, data from SWOG was presented where they looked at a randomized phase three trial looking at bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dex versus that standard of care, lenalidomide and dexamethasone. And you can see that the three-drug regimen was superior. Now, you do have a few more adverse events, but that's what you have to monitor and watch these patients closely. So those neurologic changes, because now you've added bortezomib in there, some pain, GI symptoms. But those are the things you're going to monitor with almost every therapy we put on these patients. So another trial is the IFM trial. This is the French group, along with the United States, of Dana-Farber. This is the phase three trial. This data is actually from the French trial. We're still enrolling in the United States on our portion. So it looked at RVD again. All patients got three cycles of induction, went on to a cyclophosphamide stem cell collection, and were randomized to either early or late transplant. Everybody continued on therapy. So again, we don't have the data from our portion of the trial, and we're still enrolling, but already data is showing us that that transplant piece is superior. So if you've been dealing with myeloma for a while, you know that the trend goes back and forth. Transplant's been a mainstay of myeloma for some time. 10 years ago, we started cherry picking a little bit, maybe delay some of these transplants. But the data is telling us and pointing to transplant up front is better for our patients. And you certainly, a patient with high risk features, wouldn't want to delay moving on to transplant. The other piece to remember with the French trial is that their maintenance arm stopped. So in the United States, we have access to these drugs. We continue on maintenance, and our trial continues on maintenance as well in the United States. So that data is a little different. So it'll be interesting to see what the data looks like when we have it from the U.S. Also of note, a European trial, anybody older than 65 would not be considered for transplant. So if you work at a transplant center, in the United States, 70s, there's probably somebody out there who's transplanted an 80-year-old. But we look more at that performance status, and they have that 65 cutoff. So when we look at our patient, he didn't want to do a clinical trial, so he did go on to do RVD. He was in ISS stage 1. He didn't have any associated high-risk features with his disease. He got stem cells collected after 4 cycles, went on to transplant. At day 100, he was in complete remission and was placed on lenalidomide maintenance. And I'm sorry in your slides that transplant is missing on yours. At our center, we're very aggressive with maintenance, and I don't know if Jonathan wants to add to that, but even a patient in complete remission, we're going to offer them maintenance on that. The median time to progression after a transplant without maintenance is 2 to 3 years. With maintenance, 4 years and on that. So this patient did well for 4 years, starts to develop asymptomatic biochemical relapse. And so you have to think about that. When these patients start to progress, we don't necessarily immediately want to start treating them. It's a little bit difficult for a patient. We kind of go back to that stage before they had symptoms and look at that. So we want to watch a biochemical relapse very carefully. We don't want to wait until they have symptoms and come in with a fracture. But again, they might be an IgG myeloma who starts to have a free light rise. You're going to watch that carefully. You might decide to get a marrow just to recheck disease status or a PET to make sure you're not missing something, a surprise on the disease, because as we know with myeloma, disease can change. So this patient, again, did well for 4 years, biochemical relapse over a period of time about 12 months, and now has a protein again of 1.2, some anemia. So we're starting to see symptoms, and it's time to treat. So what do we do with this patient at this point? Because again, you looked at those NCCN guidelines, it's all over, right? So a few definitions as we move on. Relapsed myeloma, this is a previously treated patient who after a period of being off therapy requires salvage treatment. Your refractory patients is disease that is non-responsive while on therapy or progresses within 60 days of the last therapy. And then we have that relapse refractory. These are your patients who never really had much of a response. They didn't even achieve a minor response or better, and they become unresponsive while on salvage therapy or within 60 days of their last treatment. And this is something you're probably familiar with. This is the pattern of myeloma patients. We have different variations of this, but it's a period of asymptomatic active and then relapse. And you can look and see, again, your patient, as we start frontline treatment, they tend to have a longer response for a while, but as they start going out in that relapse, when they're starting to be more exposed to multiple therapies, less response, less duration. And by the time we get to refractory, at that point, our goal of therapy is very different than we were up front. Up front, we want to drive these people into remission. No minimal residual disease. You hear a lot about MRD testing. But in that refractory, you know, your goals change. You want to get stabilization of disease and not have further damage. So when we're thinking about how do we treat these patients, you know, first and foremost, you want to remember there's a person sitting in front of you. You know, in myeloma, we get very caught up in numbers and charts and how you're responding. But we want to remember that patient. What was their last therapy? What kind of side effects do they have from those therapies? What are their other comorbidities? So you want to think about those things. But when we're looking at the disease characteristics, we want to look at how deep was their response? How rapidly are they progressing? Is this somebody like our patient has a slow biochemical relapse? Or is this person just rapidly progressing where you have to do something now? So these are all things that we want to consider. Always a clinical trial. And then you also want to think about, could this patient be a candidate for another transplant? And so here's a schema of what we look at with your relapse patient. So a transplant patient, transplant eligible, if they relapse post-transplant within a year, you really don't want to think about another transplant because we know they're only going to have respond about, get half that response. Somebody who comes back to us who's 4 years out, you at least want to have that discussion. You know, we have all these new therapies, so we don't always go back to transplant like we used to, but we still have patients out there that are 5 and 6 years out, 7 years, that have done well, that haven't had any of these new agents, and you want to think about another transplant on them, and then a different maintenance type program. And you can see, so a patient who progresses in that first year, you're going to do something different. Your non-transplant patients, again, you're looking at how quickly they relapsed on that last treatment. Somebody who had an induction and maybe a year later is progressing, you could actually consider that same therapy again. So these are a few of the newer agents that are approved in the relapsed and refractory setting. Two new proteasome inhibitors, carfilzomib and exasomib. We have pomalidomide and an HDAC inhibitor, panobinostat, and we've already shown these a little bit. So I'm going to run through a few of these drugs, and then I'm going to be turning it back over to Jonathan. So pomalidomide, the newer IMID, a little more potent than lenalidomide was. We have yet a newer IMID right now that we're using on clinical trials, coming your way soon. This is a 4 milligram dose. The thing with this particular one, it is myelosuppressive. So you do have to watch patients' counts. In the relapsed setting, again, you're not going to be using this single agent. You're going to typically have it with something else. And so you've got to watch those counts. You want them on something for DVT prophylaxis. Any IMID, no matter what the dose, you want to prophylax for clots. Fatigue, you know, it's a big problem in our world for everything. And, you know, patients want that quick fix. And then you have to tease out, is it the drug, is it depression, is it pain, all those things. But fatigue can be a big problem with this drug as well. And you can see those. We don't see a lot of neuropathy with pomalidomide, a little more constipation. So carfilzomib, this is a newer proteasome inhibitor. You had bortezomib, and now carfilzomib. It's a little more directed on its therapy, so we don't see the same neuropathy that we saw with bortezomib. It's IV. When we used it in the early clinical trials, the 003, 004, we hydrated the heck out of these patients, and we started seeing all these pulmonary symptoms and cardiac symptoms, and we were referring them to the specialist, and a lot of it had to do with the hydration. But there is a component, about 20-25% of patients can have cardiac toxicity with this drug. So if you're putting a patient on this drug who has CHF, you really want to look at it. And so dose modifications, getting an echo. We also know the first cycle of treatment with carfilzomib, you can see a lot of shortness of breath anyhow. So you really need to monitor these patients closely. If it continues, then you really want to assess them to make sure that you're not getting cardiac toxicity. Fevers are a little unique to this one, and it's not when they're receiving it, it's when they go home. So, you know, making sure the patient knows. Again, some anemia. It's two consecutive days, 3 weeks on, 1 week off. I will tell you that in clinical trials, we push the doses much higher. The starting dose for carfilzomib is 20 milligrams per meter square, and you escalate it up to 27. But on clinical trials, we're pushing it to 56 and 72 milligrams per meter squared, again, because you don't have that associated neuropathy. And in practice, we go to weekly if a patient can tolerate it. So we do that pretty frequent. This is the ASPIRE trial that helped get carfilzomib approved. It was a phase 3 that, again, looked at standard of care, lenalidomide and dex, and said, can we make it better if we add carfilzomib? And just like induction trials, the answer is yes. We did make it better. Three drugs were better than two drugs. And this is the ENDEAVOR trial that compared carfilzomib and dexamethasone versus bortezomib and dexamethasone. And some of these patients had prior proteasome inhibitor exposure. And again, remember, these are relapse refractory patients. And again, the arm that had carfilzomib did better. Zasimib, this on clinical trial was MLN-9708. We've used it for years. This is an oral version of proteasome inhibitor. You know, patients now have an option to get an all-oral regimen. It's also been used in the upfront setting on clinical trial, but it's approved in combination with lenalidomide and dexamethasone. This is the trial, the tourmaline trial that, again, looked at standard of care, Lendex, versus azacitinib, Lendex. And you can see the numbers. You know, we had more CR rates, overall response rate a little better. But in general, the numbers were better, and it could overcome some of those high-risk features that you saw in patients. The dosing on this with azacitinib is they receive it once a week. 3 weeks on, 1 week off. Starting dose is 4. Again, in clinical practice, I can tell you we do things a little different. Not everybody tolerates 4 milligrams. If they're in the post-transplant setting, we tend to dose at 3 milligrams and escalate up if they can tolerate it. They got weekly dex with this, and lenalidomide was your standard dosing, 3 weeks on, 1 week off. Some things about this, you wanted to have your patient take it about the same time every day, 1 hour before food or 2 hours after. It shouldn't be taken with dex. Antiviral prophylaxis, always with any proteasome inhibitor. At our center, we put people on an antiviral and essentially leave them on it. Again, if it's in combination, which is how it's approved with an IMiD, you do want to have that thromboprophylaxis in there.
So, Charisse, you mentioned that you use it in different ways. While it's approved with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, any other ways of using it?
We do. do you want to talk about that?
I was just saying that while that is what led to the approval, we've used with the same schedule and dose in possibly the maintenance setting after transplant, and we currently have a study. We've used it in combination. We really have used it in combination with other drugs like we've used bortezomib or other proteasome inhibitors with other drugs and found it to be safe and effective. And there's emerging data, clinical trial data, to demonstrate that also.
Mm-hmm. In our practice, in the maintenance setting, we'll use it on patients who are 414 positive because we know those patients are sensitive to a proteasome inhibitor. And so when you're committing them to a maintenance route, you know, now we have this oral option when we can get it approved, which is nice. So you can see the adverse reactions that occurred in 20% or greater. You know, we have some GI things, some thrombocytopenia. You know, it's that transient platelet drop that we saw with bortezomib. No different on that. 3 weeks on, 1 week off, some edema. And, you know, you've got dex on board, too. So you've got to take that into consideration. Some patients, when they're dosed on it the first time, have some flu-like symptoms, and they'll call. And it's like, I took this pill, and I have all this pain, everything hurts, and then they don't want to take it again. And so you kind of have to work them through it with the next dose. Let's try to hang on there, take a little Tylenol, and try it again. And most people can tolerate it after they've gotten a few doses in. And then again, we always have that option of dose reducing to 3 milligrams.
Yeah. The only final practice point about using exacerbib is that you have to remind your patient that they have 3 pills for an entire month, and they take them the same day every week until it's over, so that's only 3. On clinical trials, when this message was not driven home, patients took this medication on consecutive days, and that is extremely dangerous. Patients get very confused when they only have 3 pills for an entire month, so it's very important to educate the patient to take it correctly.
Mm-hmm. Good point. All right, pantobinostat. This is a histone deacetylase inhibitor, so HDAC inhibitor. This is the first one that's been approved for myeloma. It's also an oral drug. It does not have single-agent activity. It was approved in combination with a proteasome inhibitor. It was approved with bortezomib, but we are using it with carfilzomib as well on trials. This essentially helps to turn on tumor suppressor genes. This is the Panorama trial that looked at pantobinostat, bortezomib, and Velcade versus Velcade index. And the three drugs, again, you see a theme here. The three drugs were superior to the two-drug regimens. This is the dosing. Pantobinostat is dosed every other day, so day 1, 3, 5. For 2 consecutive weeks. This is how it was approved with the proteasome inhibitor, and you can see the dex. Again, I'm going to tell you how we do it in clinical practice. This has a lot of GI toxicities, and so we have found that our patients tolerate this much better if we dose it every other week. And we can keep them on a lot longer as well. Side effects. You want to avoid these fruits. And just a word, I think we already mentioned, I'm not sure, but with proteasome inhibitors, going back, you want to make sure that your patient avoids vitamin C on that. This is, you want to make sure they have antidiarrheals. Again, lots of GI toxicities. You want to obtain a baseline EKG for these patients and monitor their electrolytes, and they can have some elevated transaminases with this. And always watch their blood counts. Again, when you look at the GI, the diarrhea. So again, when you dose it that every other week, it really helps with that. So fatigue, again, central theme, some nausea and vomiting, and some, we do see some fevers with that as well. So this brings us back to our patient. Yeah, it's a challenge sometimes in the United States when we choose that next line of therapy because most of our patients have been exposed to lenalidomide or maintenance post-transplant. So our patient, though, elected an oral regimen of IRD with exacerbib. He didn't progress on bortezomib. We gave him those 4 cycles, collected cells, and went to transplant. So it's reasonable to retry the drug on that. And he did well for 24 months, and now he's progressing with anemia and bone pain. What treatment at this point would you consider next?
We're still in the in this range here. Oh, we can't see this. So we still have a group of drugs that we can use, and I would say when we come back here in 5 years, we'll be talking more and more about this group of drugs. From an investigational standpoint, just like we see all over oncology, we're starting to look at things like checkpoint inhibitors. The bispecific antibodies are going to be developed in myeloma, looking at CAR T cells in myeloma, among others. But what we have now for refractory disease is what we consider very, it's something very exciting in myeloma, is the development of monoclonal antibodies. There are many monoclonal antibodies that have been tested in myeloma and show some efficacy. There are two that are approved, and I'll spend some time talking about them, both elotuzumab and daratumumab. And they work via multiple mechanisms. For example, daratumumab, the monoclonal antibody that targets CD38, directly induces apoptosis, and we can see single-agent response, and I'll show you that clinical data. But in addition to that, both of these drugs work by enhancing the immune system, either through ADCC or CDC or other mechanisms to upregulate the T cell component of the immune system. And what we found is that when we use these drugs in combination with the IMIDs, that they can be very even more effective. And so, again, from a monoclonal antibody standpoint, a new mechanism of action, unlikely to be impacted by the standard resistance mechanisms we see with myeloma in the context of alkylating agents, IMIDs, and proteasome inhibitors. It can be combined with other therapies. We think because of the relative safety of these medications that we can use it in all settings in myeloma. There are now clinical trials in the smoldering setting, clinical trials using it upfront, clinical trials looking at the maintenance therapy. From a disadvantage standpoint, obviously, just like we've seen over the past 20 years with the use of rituximab, there are some serious infusion-related reactions. In a large part, we can overcome all of that. We don't really know yet, from a biomarker standpoint, which patient will respond and won't respond. And then finally, these are very cumbersome and expensive to produce, and hence they're very costly. So elotuzumab, again, it targets SLAMF7. SLAMF7 is a cell surface protein that lives on both myeloma cells and NK cells. And so the hypothesis is that the elotuzumab tags myeloma cells for ADCC, and by also targeting the NK cells, activates the NK cells through NK-dependent destruction of myeloma cells, and can be independent of other cellular mechanisms. And I'll show you the clinical data to show its efficacy. This was some of the first studies looking at combination of elotuzumab Blendex. There was a small study that looked at elotuzumab as a single agent, which did not show efficacy. So again, we don't think elotuzumab is directly inducing apoptosis. So when combined with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, we saw that even in patients who had prior exposure to lenalidomide, there was a high response rate, over 90%. And again, when we think about lenalidomide and dex alone, we're looking more like the 60-70% response rate. There was then a large phase 2 study that tried to ask the question, what's the optimal dose of elotuzumab given with combination of lenalidomide and dexamethasone? And that's what this study looked at, looking at, again, the 10 versus 20 milligram dosing of elotuzumab given weekly for the first two cycles and then every other week after that. From what we learned is that there is not significant amount of excessive toxicity by adding elotuzumab to lenalidomide and dexamethasone. In a large part, all of these toxicities that you see in these combination studies are the expected toxicities you see with lenalidomide. The only additional toxicity we see with elotuzumab, again, has to do with the infusion-related reactions. And so, again, in a larger study, still relatively small, we saw response rates higher than what we'd expect with lenalidomide dexamethasone alone. And what was very unique about this is that actually the lower dose of the elotuzumab appeared to be more effective than the higher dose, suggesting that this really was a sophisticated coordination of immune system and not just direct cell kill. And so these initial studies led to this large randomized study that's now been published in the New England Journal of Medicine last year called the Eloquent 2. This was a randomized study for patients with relapsed myeloma, 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy, and received standard both arms received standard Lendex. The experimental arm added the elotuzumab. And as you see here, both in this chart, showing a median progression-free survival of 19 months versus 15 months, and you see the Kaplan-Meier curve next to it, is that there was a benefit of adding elotuzumab, and that benefit was sustained over many years. And so it was this led to the approval of elotuzumab again and used in combination with lenalidomide dexamethasone. We are now studying elotuzumab with other IMiDs and in other combinations, as well moving it into the upfront setting. I did want to point out toxicities. Again, in a large part, most of the toxicities has to do with lenalidomide dexamethasone. There is somewhat more fatigue associated with it, and there are other slightly increased toxicities, but overall very well tolerated. The big key toxicity has to do with infusion-related reactions, and most of the infusion-related reactions occurred in the first cycle, some in the second cycle, and very rarely after that. And again, most of the infusion-related reactions were grade 1 or grade 2. And we do standard prophylaxis with corticosteroids, Tylenol, and Benadryl. And again, and we have found, because we have patients who were on the original phase 1 study, that we've had patients who have tolerated this for, I believe, over 5 years.
Yeah.
And the patient's still doing very well. Now, daratumumab, quite frankly, has been the single drug in myeloma that's been associated with the most excitement, at least within the myeloma field. Now, I think we all were very excited about it. The reality is that it is an effective drug, but it's not going to be the final answer for how to manage myeloma. But it has made enormous amount of changes in how we treat myeloma. Again, it's active as a single agent, and I'll show you that data. And there's very good randomized, now published data that the combination of daratumumab plus lenalidomide and dexamethasone, again, similar to what I just showed you, is superior to lenalidomide and dexamethasone alone. Most common, there's some very unique things about how to manage a patient on daratumumab. Again, most commonly are the infusion-related reactions. So in the initial studies, there was about, as a single agent, there was about a 30% response rate. And that 30% response rate was even in patients who had been refractory to all these other lines of therapy. And so in a highly refractory patient, about, and this is how we communicate with patients, about 1 in 3 patients will respond. What's interesting is another one-third of patients will have some benefit, but not a formal response. And those patients, you will note, also have a prolonged survival compared to those patients who have no response at all. So there's something, even if it's not responding, there's something about how it impacts the immune system that carries on after we stop giving daratumumab. And so this is a waterfall plot of a small study, 32 patients who received a combination of daratumumab, Len-Dex. And you'll notice of these patients, the very high response rate. If you look at any benefit at all, almost 90% of patients benefited from this therapy, including a significant percent of patients, a third of patients achieving a CR. And so I'll back up 1 second. Again, I'll mention, just published, I think in the New England Journal of Medicine 2 or 3 weeks ago, was the daratumumab plus Len-Dex versus lenalidomide dexamethasone alone. And there was not only a higher response rate, which we would have predicted based on the small study, there was a dramatic improvement in early progression-free survival. And it's way too early to have any predictions about overall survival. So while approved currently as a single agent, the data is very clear that it's very beneficial in combination. And then the other combination that we have studied and shown very good responses. Now, just looking at this study numerically, it appears that the responses are lower. But remember, when we're looking at pomalidomide studies, we're looking at much later in their course of therapy. And these patients were more likely to be relatively early in their course and a more of a relapse patient. These patients here are more in the refractory setting. And again, we see, you can see in the waterfall plot and the data itself, you see a very high response rate. And now here, you see a VGPR rate in a refractory setting with this three-drug combination of over 40%. I will comment, and I know that Charisse in our practice knows this, with pomalidomide having a higher incidence of myelosuppression, we have to monitor these patients' counts very carefully. And as you imagine the schedule, it's 4 consecutive weeks of daratumumab and 3 weeks of pomalidomide. And we see that patient on day 22. And it's very common on that day 22 for the patient to have significant amount of neutropenia, grade 3, grade 4 neutropenia. And so we have to be prepared with growth factors, with supportive care to support those patients through that period of neutropenia. So I strongly urge you, if you treat a patient on this regimen, really pay attention to the neutropenia and think about prophylactic growth factors or growth factor support and prophylactic antibiotics. And so in terms of infusion reactions, there are a higher percentage of patients get infusion reactions with daratumumab compared to elotuzumab. About 50% of patients get infusion reactions with the first dose. It's closer to 10% with the second dose, and very rare with third dose and beyond. Common symptoms, again, the things that you'd expect: throat irritation, cough, dyspnea, wheezing. Very rarely does it cause such severe side effects that a patient has to be hospitalized. And correct me if I'm wrong, I can't remember ever hospitalizing a single patient for a DARA infusion reaction.
We haven't.
Yeah, and we probably have treated, 400 patients. So we don't expect a hospitalization. But what you need are your infusion nurses to be very aware of how to manage it. Early recognition of infusion reactions, holding, re-administering pre-medications, Tylenol, Benadryl, corticosteroids, and we add the leukotriene inhibitors. It's very important to do that, and we found with first dose we can really minimize serious infusion reactions with the addition of the leukotriene inhibitors.
Just to mention, and you want to make sure they get that at least an hour before.
And then finally, once their symptoms have resolved, we can restart, and we usually go at half the rate and can often finish that dose in that day. Other really important points about this is that we're trying to measure the patient's monoclonal immunoglobulin or monoclonal antibody. Daratumumab is a monoclonal antibody, and you can actually detect it on your serum protein electrophoresis. And if you don't have a pathologist or you send out to a central lab your serum protein electrophoresis, they're going to be confused and they're going to call daratumumab a paraprotein and there might not be one there. So it's very important that they know that. Again, as Charisse mentioned before, in patients who are on almost all of our regimens, we think about varicella zoster prophylaxis. And just one brief comment, we don't give the varicella zoster vaccine. In fact, if you read the package insert, it says myeloma patients can't get it, so don't give it. I think it's an interesting study, but it hasn't been done yet. And then the final point about daratumumab is that daratumumab interferes with our ability to do cross-matching, and so it's very important that we know that beforehand. It's important that we get a type and screen, and we understand what the patient's type is. It's very important that if the patient's traveling, that they have some information that they're on daratumumab, which can interfere with the type and screening and cross-matching. And there are ways for your blood bank lab to address that and get accurate typing. And so I'll turn it back over to Charisse.
Okay, so back to our patient. So we did start this patient on pomalidomide, daratumumab, and dex. Thromboprophylaxis due to the pomalidomide, type and screen was sent prior to daratumumab. We also give out cards to our patients that they can carry. We did this on the clinical trials, and we do it in our practice. So again, if they're somewhere else or they're in an accident, they've got that information that they're on this antibody. And for this patient, responded like the data shows you, tolerating and currently responding to therapy. So dara is given weekly for the first two cycles, and then it goes to every other week, and then at cycle 7, it goes to monthly. Now, again, in clinical practice, we do that, but if our patient starts to look like they're losing their response, we'll increase the frequency back on dara again on that. I tell you, patients really like that regimen, and they're very unhappy when they have to come off of it. It's very well tolerated, especially if they're responding and it's holding them on that once a month treatment. So I think we're in summary now, Jonathan. All right. So myeloma, while it's not curable, the median overall survival has improved dramatically in the past decade, and that's really because of all these new agents that we have. The goal of therapy is to improve that depth and duration of response up front, and then in that relapse setting, get a response, keep them stable. These toxicities are really quite manageable, but we do have to monitor closely for these patients, make dose modifications, consider those other comorbidities that they have. And clinical trials, can't say enough about it. It's how we have all these drugs for myeloma. That's it, and we're happy to take questions.
Thank you.
This isn't a myeloma question, but it's a CLL. If they're CD38,
yeah,
positive, can we use daratumumab?
That's a great question. When the original phase one study mostly looked at that, and there's did not appear to be any efficacy in CLL. There was just a case report that came out in there's the NKT cell lymphoma that there was efficacy. So I think sort of thinking about CD38 positive diseases, I think is the right way to think. It doesn't work in CLL, and I'm sorry I can't remember, but it was some rare T cell lymphoma that responded, and there was at least a case report on that. That's very, very interesting. But I think looking at CD38 positive diseases in daratumumab treatment will likely be more common.
You mentioned no vitamin C with a panobinostat?
No, with a proteasome inhibitor.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah. I was talking about panobinostat and went back to that. Mm-hmm.
I just have a question. How long do you go for response to the monoclonal antibodies? Like how long, when should you see response, right away?
Yeah, I think in elotuzumab Lendex, the median time to response was in the first two cycles. And I've never seen a patient go from cycle one to cycle two whose numbers got worse, who subsequently got better. So even if they haven't had, and so this is this Elo-Lendex, even if they haven't had a response, you'd expect to see some improvement in that first cycle. Now, having said that, unless the patient's very sick, I would at least give several cycles before stopping a therapy. And daratumumab in a large part is the same way. If daratumumab is going to work, we're going to see that benefit early.
With the thromboprophylaxis, Do you use low-dose aspirin, full-dose aspirin?
Yeah. Charisse, you want
to? That's a good question. So the International Myeloma Working Group recommendations are for somebody who have no other risk factors and have no previous history, so active patient, aspirin is sufficient, and typically it's a low-dose aspirin, 81 milligrams. On our clinical trials, frequently we have to give higher doses. For somebody who has another risk factor, again, they've had a prior clot, you're going to be more aggressive with that low molecular weight heparin. You know, there are a lot of the newer agents, and we use them in our practice, the newer oral agents, Xarelto.
I would say that the risk factors to look at, I think the two most important risk factors to look at are going to be, again, prior history of clot or immobility. Mm-hmm. If these patients have just had some sort of orthopedic procedure because of myeloma and they're in a wheelchair or they spend a significant amount of time a day in bed, then you're going to want to give a more aggressive anticoagulation than just aspirin. So the standard risk, again, no history of blood clots, fully mobile, we'll give an aspirin. Otherwise, we'll give something more, either prophylactic dosing of Lovenox, the new anticoagulants, or warfarin with a goal INR of 2 to 3.
Now, we also, if our patients are traveling, we have a lot of people that are working and going about life. And if they're traveling on long flights overseas, that kind of thing, then we're a little more aggressive if they're that person who's only on an 81 milligram aspirin. And there's no data behind it, but it's what we do. So we typically give them Lovenox the day before they travel, the day they travel, and day after. And then we're discussing whether we really need to do that day after. But that's just because we've seen a lot of that too. They go off on a long flight and come back with a clot.
When you're thinking about the monoclonal antibodies in the relapse refractory setting, is there one you would choose before the other? I think the DARA works on the CD38 and the ELO works on the other.
Right.
And I think you would want to use the ELO first.
That's the question that everybody's asking, and every myeloma doctor asks it because we don't know the right answer. The general approach, and I say this as a general approach because it's not, nobody's compared this head to head. It's not known if it's true. But in general, the less aggressive relapses, sort of that earlier asymptomatic rise, we're more likely going to choose elotuzumab Lendex. Somebody who has refractory disease or a more aggressive relapse where we really need the highest possible response rate, we're more likely to use daratumumab.
And we run into the issues because so many of our patients have already progressed on lenalidomide. And so I think in our practice, we're probably putting more people on dara because you can just add it in, and typically with pomalidomide.
I have a question about maintenance therapy with RD. How often do you drop out the D?
Yeah, so in the maintenance setting after transplant, in the standard risk patient, we give lenalidomide by itself. If we are using, let's say, for example, the study showed in the non-transplant setting, they used Lendex until progression. Our typical practice is to recognizes that in a regimen where you don't have a transplant in the maintenance portion, that lenalidomide is going to be the more important of the drugs. And so in the upfront setting, we'll stop it also after the initial induction therapy and go straight with lenalidomide without dexamethasone. Now, in the relapse setting, when we're using a three-drug regimen, you've had a response and you're maintaining remission, it's a little bit less clear about what to do with the dexamethasone. And in that setting, we really based our dexamethasone dosing on the tolerance of the patient. And instead of having a fixed time when we stop the dexamethasone, we really just pay attention to what the patients are telling us and stop dexamethasone based on toxicity.
Thank you.
with the Dex, I have patients complaining all the time that taking 40 on one day drives them crazy, and they're asking me, can't I take 5 or 8 every day? Does that make a difference? And when do you start your maintenance lenalidomide after transplant?
Yeah. So it's a great question, and I appreciate you asking it. Every time I've seen patients, let me say it differently. The efficacy of taking daily dexamethasone is probably the same. The immediate toxicity of spreading the dexamethasone out is obviously better. The long-term toxicity in terms of suppressing the adrenal axis is much, much higher when you give it every day as opposed to you give it in pulses. And so I do not let my patients do that. Every time I've ever seen somebody come in Cushingoid, it's because they're on daily dexamethasone. And so it's very important. We sometimes negotiate it and we let them split it twice a week. But we see long-term toxicity with dexamethasone is much higher when it's given daily as opposed to given pulses. And I forgot the second
question. Maintenance question. So we risk stratify our patients. So a standard risk patient post-transplant, we're going to restage at day 100, and then we start maintenance at that point. So lenalidomide, single agent. And we go to a lower dose on that. Typically it's 10 milligrams. For our high-risk patients, we actually do a multi-drug regimen, and it depends on what the disease is. If they have a 17p deletion, if they have a 414. Again, if they have a 414 translocation, we're going to do something like exasimib or bortezomib, single agent on that. The high-risk patients, we had been giving lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dex for a period of 3 years, and then they went to maintenance lenalidomide single agent after that. We're changing. We're doing a lot more now with carfilzomib, pomalidomide, in that maintenance setting post-transplant. But we commit them to 3 years of pretty aggressive maintenance, and we have some really nice response rates with that as well. We know single agent will not hold a high-risk patient. Your patient with a 17p deletion, somebody who presented with plasma cell leukemia, they need more aggressive maintenance.
Great.
We restage those patients at day 60. We don't wait till day 100 because we found, we had those patients blasting off with disease by day 100. So we get them in at day 60, restage, and get maintenance going at that point.
So do you ever use the Revlimid plus the new, it's Nilaro, Azacinmib, however you say that. Do you ever use that as maintenance together?
We do. We have, again, those patients who want that oral regimen, and so we have started doing IRD, so Azacinmib, Lenalidomide, Dex, on that.
This concludes this podcast from the 2016 JADPRO Live at APSHO Conference. To view the presentation material or see other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2016. To claim continuing educational credit for these activities, visit education.annenberg.net/JPL16-sessions.